how to cope with an alcoholic family member. And so I invited Susan to be on the show. And we also have Chris Nelson, who is a RN and can help us address some of the physiological impact of alcohol and drug addiction. And we have Susan, who has the experience of an alcoholic spouse who she left, and we'll talk about that. And Rahashia Poe is the author of a book about how to cope with addiction using meditation and kind of a spiritual approach. And he's also the co-editor of The Lotus Guide. And we have Jennifer Cavarello, who is the CEO of Skyway House, a treatment center. So let's start with Susan. Tell us a little bit about your experience with your alcohol husband family issue.
Well, when I entered the relationship, I was naive. I wasn't aware that I was in relationship with an alcoholic. I was dealing with his alcohol, his love of an overindulgence of alcohol. And it took me, actually, I was so naive, it took about 5 years before I realized that, hey, I'm married to an alcoholic. But I stayed in the marriage for many, many years and had, well, we were good at family, and we have a wonderful family. But it was very difficult to be married to an alcoholic. You can count on unpredictability is the most predictable aspect of the relationship, unpredictable behavior. And it wasn't until I saw that my kids were being affected by it that I could do something about it. It wasn't for myself as much as I could for my kids. I needed to do what I had to do.
How were they being affected?
Emotional, I guess you would say emotional abuse when you have a parent who is unpredictable. And what I have to say is I own my my part of it as well. I had many problems, otherwise I wouldn't have been in. I was half of the relationship. I just didn't have an alcohol problem, and it was when he was driving with the kids and they were and he was drunk.
Oh boy.
That's when I was just beside myself. I didn't know how to stop that behavior. So when I called the police and I asked, what can I do about this? They said nothing. Basically, he would have had to get in an accident before anything would have happened to him. And so I can't remember how. Somebody had me call. I think I called AA. That's what I did. And I said, how can I stop my husband from driving with my kids? And she said, you need to go to Al-Anon. And I said, but you don't understand. I don't have a drinking problem. And she kept telling me over and over. She was practically over the phone hitting me over the head and saying, you have to go to Al-Anon. And so she said it enough times that I did. I did go to Al-Anon. And that is why I'm here on the show, because that's what I told you in your response that was missing. That was the key for me. It was at that point, I became responsible for my life, and I stopped focusing on him, what he was doing wrong, and I started becoming healthy in myself. And this was a very, very long time ago, and it doesn't happen overnight. But I can't speak highly enough for Al-Anon and the 12-step program.
What was the message that you got from Al-Anon?
Well, the 12 steps, I think it's a beautifully designed program. It's anonymous. It's, first of all, you admit that you have a problem, that you're powerless, and that you admit that there's a power greater than yourself. It doesn't matter what you believe in, and that you will turn yourself, you will surrender to that greater power, and you can just look at it as your higher power. And so the steps are, they're just beautiful, and admitting that is key right there. And being in a group with other people who share the same issues, you get to learn from other people. And so I just gained tools. I mean, there were other things that I did along the way, but this would be the first step in setting boundaries for myself and owning my own behaviors. And that's when I had an aha moment. I still didn't leave my marriage for a few years after that, but it was the day when I realized that as soon as I got myself okay, my kids would be okay. And that's when I knew I was ready to leave the relationship. And I had a wonderful counselor, too.
Was there a particular catalyst for leaving, or it was just kind of an accumulation and it's like the straw that broke the camel's back, or what was the...
Oh, there were many... There was more than alcohol. There was drugs. It was not good. It's not a good situation. And I was just so very unhappy that I knew one way or another I would probably be dead in 10 years. Well, somehow or other, that's how unhappy I was. And I have to say that that's a different lifetime ago. That's another person. And I'm so happy to be where I am right now. And I wish him well. And
did he ever stop drinking?
I couldn't tell you for sure whether he has or not. I don't know. I honestly couldn't tell you.
You mentioned the higher power, and I've talked to a lot of people who say, I don't want to go to AA, I don't want to go to Al-Anon because of the higher power, I don't believe in one. And Jennifer, I know that that's something you have a approach to talking about. What would you say to those people who say, I'm sorry, I don't believe in a higher power, so I don't want a 12-step program?
Well, I had shared with you, Gail, my own personal journey in recovery, and that was a challenge for me. I didn't have a higher power. I didn't have spirit, God, you can call it whatever you want. I didn't have a spiritual path. And so that was a real struggle for me personally. And I know that I had a real awakening when I was in a 12-step meeting and I heard somebody say, you know, God is my higher power, and God, G-O-D, is the acronym for Great Outdoors. And it really, you know, it really struck me that, wow, okay, that means something to me. There are a lot of natural forces in the universe that are clearly more powerful than I am. And so that really resonated deeply. And I think if you're around meetings long enough, you'll hear an awful lot of acronyms for God. You know, the program is not religious in its nature. It is a spiritual program. And so it calls on you to find a higher power of your own choosing, whether that is a practiced religious God, or whether that's a higher power, or whether that's a spiritual path of your own creation. I think that that's what's most important. And so, you know, I would encourage someone who is not wanting to go to a 12-step program because of that, if that's their objection, to take a broader approach and open their mind to what higher power might mean to them.
Well, while we're talking about this, do you mind sharing what brought you to a 12-step program?
Sure. So at 33, I found myself in jail, actually, because I had been on a journey of addiction my entire young adulthood. And I had recognized very early on, probably in my teenage years, that my alcoholism was a significant issue. I didn't drink like other people did. I blacked out. Once I started drinking, I couldn't stop drinking. And I recognized that behavior because I had alcoholics in my family, and I had seen that behavior. That didn't mean I had any power to change the path that I was on at that point in my life. I had tried to stop drinking, and I wasn't able to do that on my own. And so I had visited 12-step programs. I'd gone to AA in my early 20s. And at that point, all I could focus on were the differences between myself and the people in the rooms. They all seemed older. They seemed, you know, all I could see were the differences. And at that point, I simply wasn't ready to make that the focus of my life. And so I continued that path. And at 33, as I said, I found myself in jail and was really graced with an opportunity to get treatment and spent 6 months in residential treatment. And was introduced to the 12-step program, was spent a lot of time focusing on that recovery journey and building a really strong toolbox for that journey. And, you know, that was almost 18 years ago. So it's been an amazing journey, and one filled with spiritual learning and seeking and finding. It's been a pretty amazing path.
What would you say was the most powerful tool for you, that whereas before you couldn't stop drinking and then in the program, the residential program, you learned to stop? What was that key?
That's a really good question. I don't know that there is one key. I think for me, the 12-step program, initially for me, working the 12 steps was significant in a way that made me recognize that I wasn't the center of the universe, that I was not in control, and that I needed to acquiesce to that. That was a big awakening for me. And I will say that the number one thing that has been most influential in my recovery is building a strong network of social support. And I would suggest that for anyone, whether that's a 12-step program or a spiritual community, a church group, a social network, whatever that is that's going to support a healthy lifestyle and a long-term recovery journey, that's what has been most fundamental for me. My dearest friends are those that I made in that treatment center, and they are, you know, we've shared 18 years of recovery together. I know that I can call them at any time, day or night, and they would be there for me. It's an intimate relationship unlike any I've ever shared.
Have you been a sponsor for people in the program?
I have.
And so that's probably mutually enforcing both ways. It's supportive.
Absolutely. I think the biggest misnomer about sponsorship is that the sponsee is the one who gets all the benefit of the relationship. The sponsor certainly gets the benefit as well. So, yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
A lot of times people say to me, I don't want to go to AA because they're addicted to coffee and sugar and cigarettes, and it's just not appealing to me. So what would you say to someone who says that?
I would say, listen to what I just said about seeing only the differences and not looking for the similarities. I think it's really important. This is an individual journey shared. And so, the coffee and cigarettes and all that, I mean, those are all ancillary addictions in and of themselves. And so oftentimes they go along with early recovery. I think that as we get healthier, we adopt healthier ways of living. And so, we become a healthier population as a whole in recovery. But again, you're looking for the similarities, the things that bring us together and not drive us apart. There are a million reasons not to step into an AA meeting. The primary purpose of being there is the only one that should matter.
That makes a lot of sense. It's Your Body is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, a state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity through arts and culture by producing community festival and events, including Oktoberfest, Chico Palo, the True North Tour, the Silent Film Festival, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheartsupstate.org. It's also brought to you by In Town Campground, located just minutes from downtown Nevada City, providing a new, vibrant camping experience. The historic wooded 15-acre family-friendly campground is just 2 miles from downtown, offering tent sites, RV area with hookups, and deluxe canvas tents with electricity, real bed, and linens. That's my kind of tent. For reservations and information, visit In Town Campground, that's in with two N's, .com, or call 530-265-9900. Rahashia, do you think of yourself as a former addict? Tell us a little bit about your journey.
I'm still trying to figure out what I am. But before I even get started, I probably should say I do have a lot of respect for the 12-step program. Met a lot of good people. But all I can say is, like, well, what John Bradshaw once said, he was a big supporter for 30 years. He said, at the end of my 30 years, the biggest benefit I could see is the resocialization of the addict into groups.
Do you want to explain that? What does that mean, resocialization?
Resocialization? Well, getting back involved in a social group of some kind. Because when you're addicted, I mean, you end up as an individual really secluded usually towards the end of that addiction. And building relationships is hard. But getting involved in a social group is near to impossible.
Jennifer's nodding her head.
Absolutely. Isolation is the number one side effect of addiction.
Resocialization is key, yeah. You know, to getting to feeling better about yourself. Then Ram Dass once said, because he worked with the 12-step program for years and years, he said, the only thing I have to say is there's not a final step. There's no way to graduate. And I've known people in the 12-step program for, like, they go every week for 30 years, you know. And so when I found myself addicted, I had already been on this path of, I'd sat with curanderos doing mushrooms, I've been to South America doing ayahuasca, India. So I was on a spiritual path and just got addicted along the way. So
to
I
what? Had, do you mind saying?
No, cocaine, freebase, and then I got into meth. And when I got into meth, I realized, okay, I broke one addiction with the cocaine. And I was good for a while. And then I picked up another one. And I thought, okay, I'm not only addicted to drugs, I'm addicted to being me. And that is where the journey really began.
What does that mean, addicted to being me?
Well, like Joe Dispenza has a book out called Breaking the Habit of Being You. And the whole idea behind that is if you really want to glean, and I'm talking about a spiritual path right now more than a breaking addiction or anything. But if you really want to pick up good information, new information, it has to go through all your filters. And by the time it does that, you've already divided it, compartmentalized it, rationalized it out. But if you can break the habit of being you and be a clean slate, all of the information of the universe is here for you. But breaking the habit of being me was the toughest thing I ever had to do.
Your habits and preconceptions and beliefs and that.
I was an addicted personality type. And it really was, I could see right away, it's not going to matter what I'm addicted to. I have built up this personality that feeds on being addicted. I mean, actually feeds on it. The neurological thing, the chemistry thing, you know, like molecules of emotion. If we have a feeling, we have a thought, all of these things intertwine with chemistry. And we actually get addicted to being ourselves. And if that addiction is the fact that you want to be addicted to anything, you're just trading one drug, one alcohol for something else, and you find yourself 30, 40 years down the road, you know, all messed up. And so about 1995, I had some experience with bioenergetics, somatic movements, you know, Alexander Lowen, that whole movement. And I knew they were having some really good results with addiction just by moving my body. And then I ran into these meditations that were, I guess profound is about the best way I can say. Because when I started doing them, I ran into them in San Diego, doing an intense workshop, 9 days. And it was my first moment of grounding in consciousness. And I realized at that point, okay, this is my way out of addiction. Because now I found something that I want more than addicted to anything, and I can't have them both.
So it's kind of like a good addiction?
Yeah, it's kind of like a good addiction, but without the chemistry and without the, you know. So that took me on a tour all over the place, Brazil and India, and just learning these energetic meditations, you know, active meditations. And then when I was in Brazil, that's where I met Dara, and lo and behold, she teaches these meditations.
And you got married and lived happily ever after.
Yep, so far so good. And then we wrote the book, you know, the 12 Spiritual Laws of Recovery, and she did meditations for each one of the steps. And it goes over good with somebody that does it, but I have to tell you right away that most people that are on their path through addiction, they need more support than the kind of support I gave myself. They need more group adherence and everything. So the people that's done this have done really well, but they're few and far between.
Could you say the name of your book again and where people can get it and a little bit more about the approach?
Sure. It's the 12 Spiritual Laws of Recovery and Meditations for the 12-Step Program. And I knew it wouldn't go over that good with the 12-Step because our first step is what you resist, persist. And it's all about taking back our power. Because I've seen too many kids coming through the group home going, hey, there's just no way. I don't have hardly any power left. I'm not going to give what I have away. And it dawned on me that we are evolving consciously and spiritually. And we're reaching a place now where I think we all have to see that we're evolving into another level of consciousness that requires individual responsibility and taking back our power, taking back responsibility. But unfortunately, we live in a world where everything is wanting to be responsible for us. Social services, the government, and everything takes our power away, our power of choice. But there's a lot of people fighting this now and pulling it back in, go, no, I'm going to be responsible for myself. And but the meditations are key.
Can you give us an example? Is there, so we have a feeling for how these meditations work? Do we talk? Do we move? Do we
sure.
repeat?
Well, Alexander Lowen, he was primarily the guy behind bioenergetics. In all of his 25 years of doing bioenergetics, he said he'd never met one person that had free pelvic movement that had any sexual problem. We lock our problems up. We lock it up in our bodies. From the time we're like little kids, we're told to sit still, stop fidgeting, go to your room, be quiet, especially women, you know, so suppressed. So over the years, that's what we do. We go to our room, we stop fidgeting, we sit like this, real nice and polite, but all of that anxiety and frustration gets locked up in us. And unless you can unlock it, if you sit down and try to meditate, that energy is going to feed up and come out as just verbal nonsense. You know, where's my car keys? I got to go to the store, blah, 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 blah. But if you can free that up and free that energy out and then sit down, your mind is clear. And at that point, you get that moment of clear reflection of, I am. I am this existence. I am alive. And I tell you, once you have that, there's not a drug in the world that can take you to that place.
So it involves movement.
It involves movement, yeah.
And Dara Lemos teaches yeah. some of those movements.
Think of what you did when you was a little kid if you didn't want to go to school. I don't want to go to school. And you jump up and down, throw a temper. Your body knows what to do. It's going to throw a temper tantrum. But that's socially unacceptable. So we're told to be quiet, shh, and we do. We just lock it all up. And these meditations are about being active and really releasing that. You know, giving yourself full permission to be that little kid again and go, no, I don't want to vote for Trump, whatever it is, you know, and just really letting it out. But it takes work.
People say that meth users, it changes the cell receptors. It's so addictive, it's really hard to kick it. But you were able to do that.
Yep.
And was it like a huge struggle, or with these meditations it was doable?
I tell you, with the meditations, it was still difficult, you know. It still had that monkey on my back, whatever you want to say. But with the meditations, once you get a clear vision of who you are, what you want, and the direction you want to go, I mean, I was a group home manager for a year at McAllister Institute down in San Diego. And I can tell you right up front, if a kid came into that program and did not want to get clean, all you could do is make them comfortable, feed them really well, because their behavior problems would go away with some good food and water. But if they wanted to get clean, all you had to do is just get out of their way, and they were gone.
If they had support, social support.
Yeah, all they need is, like, space to do it.
Mm.
But the trouble is, I remember once I was sitting around in the group, and this little Spanish kid, you know, he says, Rahasha, man, dude, I really love you, man, and I see what you're trying to do, but, hey, here's the deal, man. I've got 30 days here. When I go home, my dad is in prison. My mom is dead. My uncle's been molesting my sister. And the list went on. He says, every single one of my friends get high. So at that point, you have to see that it's a systemic problem. Like the war on drugs hasn't worked. We have more drugs than ever. The war on poverty, we have more poverty. The war on terrorism, the war on this stuff doesn't work. We have to embrace it differently. That's the reason I say what you resist, persist. We have to embrace it and use our addictions as a vehicle for evolutionary growth of consciousness.
Beautiful.
If you don't do that, you might be able to quit drugs. And for society, that's great. But for the individual, if you're on a spiritual path towards awakening, that can actually be a place to stop, you know, which is better than nothing. But if you want to wake up spiritually and consciously, you have to embrace it and use everything about addiction. You know, use the 12-step program, but graduate, I say. You know, that's mine. And go on with it. You know, I remember once we were sitting around in a 12-step meeting, and this guy goes up and he says, "Hi, I'm Joe. I've been clean and sober for 22 years, 11 days, and and this little kid jumps up out of his chair and screams and runs outside. And I go, "What's wrong?" He says, "Man, if I have to do this the rest of my life, I can't do it." You know, I can't do it. It's too much for some kids. And for some people, it's great. You know, it's a good support, and it gets you involved with a group. You meet really lifelong friends. It's great for that. Like I say, my path isn't for everybody. But, you know.
Jennifer, is there anything that Rahasha just said that you want to comment on? It seems like that you might have some interesting perspectives.
I bet she does.
Well, it's interesting, and I probably need to be cautious because I have a personal path of recovery, and I embrace a lot of the philosophies that you're talking about. However, as CEO of Skyway House, I mean, we really embrace treatment as an initial step, followed by long-term social support. Again, 12-step, you know, a Buddhist practice, whether it's prayer and meditation, whether it's something else. I mean, we don't prescribe what it is. What we do is support you in your choice of whatever that methodology is. But I do think that people are different. I agree with you entirely. And not one program will meet the needs of everyone. And so, you know, again, as with my professional hat on, I really want people to explore what is going to work best for them. And, you know, there are a lot of different types of programs to speak to the individual. Personally, I too have embraced several different paths and have found a spiritual journey that really works for me. And part of that is the social support. I know there are millions of people universally who have found success with the 12-step program. Historically, it has been the most powerful and successful path. And so I really respect the history. I also respect that everyone's different and they need to find the path that works for them. And so, you know, that's where I am.
The beautiful thing about AA is it's free. So it's available
Absolutely.
To anybody. To me, that's gorgeous.
Absolutely. And one of the things at Skyway House that we really embrace is that if treatment, whether that's residential or outpatient, isn't going to work for you, we want to help connect you with the resources that are going to enable you to be successful for a long-term recovery. And that oftentimes is referring to a 12-step program. It's free and it's available, again, universally.
And it's everywhere.
It's absolutely everywhere. I mean,
and you
I've
have
been
a choice
in meetings all over
groups.
The world. That's
you can,
right.
You can shop around and find a group that works for you.
Absolutely. Gender-specific, age-specific, neighborhood-specific. I mean, you name it. We've got it. Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Chris, as a RN, could you tell us a little bit about the physiology of addiction? Okay. Then talk to us about the effect of alcohol on a fetus.
Okay, well, I just wanted to say I really appreciate what everybody has said so far. It's really interesting to be here. And I agree about what you resist persists, and I think that's why it's really important that, I think that's, for me, the take-home with this is to, you know, that you really have to delve in there, and that's, I guess, what the higher power is about. But I'm getting a lot out of this discussion, but when I was working at the health department, we had grants, and we tried to get prenatal help for women who were drinking, and I have to say that alcohol use by young women's gone up a lot, and they market to young kids now. They market these sweet syrupy drinks that are like soda, only they're alcohol.
It's gross.
They really, you know, it's just like the tobacco industry. They will do that, and so they find the vulnerable to sell to, and then of course the kids that end up getting addicted, sometimes they either have a genetic predisposition, which we know exists. Or a lot of times, I think that kids who have been molested or have other painful things, they will, you know, they'll self-medicate with alcohol. And then, you know, women often are poly users, which means they will use whatever they can get, basically. But what I wanted to talk about, just to get back to what you asked me, Gail, is about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And those are, if you drink during your pregnancy, there's no safe level at all. Binge drinking, of course, is the worst. You can lose many of your sweet baby's neurons. It prunes. The alcohol is a toxic to the brain, and it prunes the neurons. And the very worst cases are where the corpus callosum, which is the divider between the two hemispheres of the brain, is thinned. And so your baby won't be able to synthesize information, won't be able to understand complex ideas. It's a bad thing to do to a child. Sometimes they can't tell time. They can't figure out money in their pocket, how to pay for things. They may not be retarded. And I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to use that word. Developmentally delayed in the sense of IQ. They may have a normal IQ, but they won't be able to do life.
And connect different information.
And they won't be able to have make good moral judgments. They won't be able to do critical thinking. They basically, often the jails are full of these people who are exposed in utero. So I just wanted to put that out there as my part of this, because I just feel so deeply that, you know, we're not doing enough for women, you know, like in terms of preconception counseling, going into it, you know, along the way, in terms of what obstetricians are, you know, we don't have the services we need. I don't know if we still have Touchstone, but we in the past we did have some treatment facilities for women during pregnancy, but I don't know if we do now. But anyway, thanks for letting me come in.
Oh, thank you. What you described about pruning neurons, is that true for people who aren't fetuses, for regular kids and adults?
You know, I don't know enough about how it affects the brain. There is an encephalopathy, which means that a lot of times you're kind of, you find this in old alcoholics, so a lot of times their brains are like mushy, they can't think clearly, they're very dull, and, you know, I don't know if that's from, I think it's separate from cirrhosis of the liver. It's the toxic effect of long-term alcohol use. It makes people not being able to remember things. It's like a dementia.
Right, the cognitive response is diminished for sure.
Yeah, and we see a lot of that in the homeless population, yes. And you know, nice people, but again, you can't do life.
Right. What's the physiology of that? Excuse me. What does the alcohol do to the brain?
Well, again, diminished cognitive. I do think that it has a cumulative effect, as you were talking about. So you do see that in someone who's been drinking chronically for many years. You'll see that cognitive response. Certainly, you know that. I mean, I think we're all familiar with the short-term cognitive effects of drinking too much alcohol.
Probably so. Not. So you might want to
tell us. Well, I mean, I'm not a. I can't speak to the. Science, the brain science, but I mean, certainly there are, all the signs of impairment. So slurred speech, and you know, it's a depressant. It's a neural depressant. So your slurred speech and your vision impairment and stumbling, not being able to walk properly, a loss of control of bodily functions. So, those are the short term. And again, the long term, a chronic alcoholic, certainly we're talking about some real cognitive issues of no short term memory, just kind of a lack of functioning at that level.
Mm-hmm. Could you say a word about genetic predispositions to alcohol? Mm-hmm. What should we watch out for if we have a parent or a grandparent who's an alcoholic?
Right. So alcoholism is definitely a generational disease, and the research shows that genes can account for about half of the vulnerability, and certainly, environment and development can account for the rest. I mean, certainly there's ethnicity and the presence of other mental disorders that lend to a predisposition for alcoholism. There's a lot to be said about the environment as well. If you see that behavior, you will mimic that behavior. And there's a lot of research going on about development as well. So especially in adolescence, that points to the earlier usage will then lead to a higher likelihood of progression toward addiction. So, that we go back to the alcohol pops and the drinks that are being marketed to teeny boppers. So, I mean, that's just, unconscionable to
it's
me.
Wicked.
Right.
Susan, could you say a word about your kids? How did they cope, and what was the effect overall in terms of their relation to drugs and alcohol? Did they say, no, I'm not going to do that? Or did they, what was their what was the influence on them?
Well, I had a wonderful counselor who told me, guided me very well, and said that once I was, we were living in separate homes and the kids were going back and forth, for me to check with them every once in a while and ask them if they were ever uncomfortable with their dad's drinking, and to let them know that if they ever were, that they could call me, so that they did know that. And I don't think that, I think what it did was took the glamour out of drinking, because they saw the destruction that can happen when you drink too much. They do drink socially. It's not that they refuse to ever touch it, but, and I keep my fingers crossed that they don't have alcohol problems, but that they are not... opposed to having beers with their friends or a glass of wine and enjoying it. And when I would check with them when they were growing up, and they would say, I think that hopefully empowered them, because they would say, we're fine. And I remember there was... one time when we were all together at some function, and they were at this point they could drive, but I said, I noticed that their dad had a little bit too much to drink, but they were going home with him. So I said, I don't want you driving the kids, and my son said, that's okay, I'm driving. it was just a given. So he held out his hand for the keys. So It was quite a journey for me to surrender to that. Otherwise, my life would have been held hostage, watching over my kids all the time, And I couldn't live that way. And thank God nothing ever happened to them.
And they learned something from, sometimes we learn from adversity.
Yeah. Yes.
We're reading a lot in the news about the opiate addiction and how it's the source of a lot of deaths. It's one of the main causes of drug-related deaths in the country, and people pay attention to it because white people, middle-class people, are suffering from it. Chris or Jennifer, either one of you want to take the opiate addiction question?
Just briefly, there is a huge problem with overprescription of pain medications, and I think it's like a pendulum. For a while, you know, postoperatively, they weren't good at pain control, and then the medical thinking was, oh, this stuff can't hurt you if you're in pain, so they would give these big scripts. And then, you know, family members started to use them, and some people were getting addicted right away. But I know Oxycontin, rather, up in Paradise has caused many deaths, and you know, high school, many of the kids addicted, and so that means there's a lot of adults with prescriptions that kids are accessing. You know, I'd see
so
it
you
in
can just
Orville.
Swallow it. Just take the pill. You don't have to inject.
You don't have
it.
To do anything to have it make you high. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can mess with it. I don't know enough about it, but. You know, in Oroville, you know, families used to kill each other over these boxes of grandma's medications, you know. Oh, they'd be fighting one another to get to just steal the box that had all the narcotics, because every new doctor would prescribe narcotics, you know. And so I'm glad that there is finally recognition of how dangerous this is to give these huge doses. And I still see it all the time, you know. Somebody comes in and they're taking Norco, you know, 5 tablets a day or something like that, and they're not getting any care for the injury. They're not getting physical or occupational therapy or any alternative care, you know, like acupuncture or, you know, any kind of help. They're not getting any help for the injury, but they are still on these drugs, you know, and they don't help you in any way.
What are the side effects of the opiates besides death?
Besides death. Well, you know, I think that what they do is they just kind of disconnect you from the pain centers, but they don't really work on pain the way, say, ibuprofen does. Ibuprofen, like something like a, you know, because of what it does.
It works on inflammation.
A non-steroidal anti-inflammatory will actually relieve your pain for, you know, 4 hours or whatever, and that's that works well. Whereas it's hard on your stomach, of course, you know, you can't use it long term. But those other ones, all they do is sort of mask the pain, and they give you a sense of euphoria and kind of a la la land, a little bit of that. But I don't really think they're very good for pain. So I don't know what else they do.
Jennifer, what do you see among your clients in terms of opiate use?
We see it all the time. I mean, I would suggest that 10 or 15 years ago, we were dealing with 80% methamphetamines in terms of the people seeking treatment. The rest maybe alcohol, a little bit of heroin in there. And now it's, you know, completely reversed, and we're looking at opiate all across the board. You know, and we're talking about 18-year-old kids, and we're talking about 65-year-old grandmas and everything in between. We're talking about your soccer mom who gets in a car accident and is prescribed opiates as a painkiller, and then finds that she's doctor shopping and, you know, taking risky behaviors and illegal steps to get her medication. And we're talking about kids who are taking their grandparents' medication, and we're talking about people who are buying it off the street. And I think that just as important as the opioid discussion in terms of painkillers, we're also talking about heroin, because that's had a massive resurgence. And we are seeing many of our clients step from opioid pain medication to heroin because it's much cheaper and easier to get. So
really? Heroin's cheaper and easier? You
absolutely.
Just get it black market on the street kind
absolutely.
Of a deal.
Absolutely. much easier, much cheaper, much more available.
Wow.
And, you know, pain medication is actually more difficult to come by. I mean, you do need a prescription or a source. And so what happens is somebody is out of their meds and heroin's available. It costs a fraction of what the pills cost and it's available. And, you know, now that's a whole nother conversation that we're having. So we have a lot of young heroin addicts coming into service as a recent wave.
And you have to shoot up to ingest heroin?
No, you can smoke it you don't have to shoot up.
Oh, so you could have a kid who was using it and there wouldn't be any tracks on their arms or anything?
Correct. I mean, it's a progressive disease, so ultimately that's going to be the outcome. But that's true. You could absolutely be using heroin and not have tracks. And there are a lot of places to shoot up, so tracks aren't always on your arms. I mean, there's just, you know, addicts will go to any lengths.
It's Your Body is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Yang Professional Chiropractic, offering chiropractic services at 2275 Meyer Street in Oroville and 1835 North Beale Street, Suite B, in Marysville. Dr. Ma Yang offers Hmong translations and accepts insurance for car accidents, sports injuries, neck and back pain, along with arm and leg pain. To reach Dr. Yang, call 533-6400. The show is also brought to you by RAW, spelled R-A-W-E, Tree Care and Preservation, for all your residential or commercial needs. With over 15 years of experience, RAW Tree Care services include pruning, but not your neurons, removal, planting, bobcat, and tractor work, chipping, fire abatement, crane, and emergency services, and custom wood milling. RAW Tree Care is locally owned and operated. It accepts all forms of insurance work and can be reached at 321-4576 or by email at rawtree@gmail.com. Before we resume talking about addiction, I wanted to let listeners know that our next show, the second Tuesday of April, will be about teaching resilience in young people. So I think it's going to be an interesting show. We'll have young people, we'll have counselors, and we're very open to your suggestions. So if you have an idea for a topic you want discussed, you can email G. Kimball, G-K-I-M-B-A-L-L, at csuchico.edu. So it's G. Kimball at csuchico.edu. And you can also take a look at my column in the Lotus Guide, since we have the editor here, and I know he'd want you to know about the magazine. Okay, I have a question for whoever on our panel. The U.S. has a tiny percent of the world's population, but it uses a majority of the drugs, prescription drugs, illegal drugs. What's the deal with our culture that we rely on drugs so much? Anybody have a take on that? Why do we stand out in our drug use, including prescription drug? Raj?
Well, I guess I can address it somewhat. I think we're in a Western society. We've tried filling a void, a gap that is a bottomless pit, and we fill it with stuff, you know, all of our toys and everything else.
What causes the void?
What is the cause of the void? It's an illusion. It's not really even there. We create it by our desires, but that gets into another kind of a show. I think we've lost the simplicity of life. We forgot to really, really look at what is important, taking out time to take a walk in the park, just the little things. And we do these things. I know I've been with people that's busy, 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 and we'll go out for a walk or a hike, and they'll go, oh, my, I need to do this more often. Yeah, you do. You know, we just have to take the time to do it. And myself, personally, with drugs, it was experimental. I was looking to push the boundaries of my own experience. And I think it starts out with a lot of people that way. From the time we're little kids, we like spin in circles and get dizzy. We like to experiment with our consciousness. It's the human condition. We push the boundaries. But unfortunately, we've entered into a realm of chemistry that with designer drugs and really potent drugs that goes far beyond the boundaries. And I think if I can just sort of add this, we are evolving. And one of the signs that we're evolving, like I'm scheduled to do an interview with Bruce Lipton next month, then Joe Dispenza. And Joe Dispenza has a book out, You Are the Placebo. And what they're finding is, and even the pharmaceutical companies are backing this up, by their statistics, most placebos are 80% as effective as the actual pharmaceutical.
I've usually seen 40, 50.
It's growing. It is growing. Something's happening right now. But what they've really found out that's interesting is we don't need to know that it's not a placebo. What Joe Dispenza is doing, I mean, thousands of people, he's at it in his workshops, he's doing all kinds of really good, intense research. They're finding out that if you take a placebo, you can know that it's a placebo and it still has the same effect. They can't quite figure that out. But I think it's because energetically, consciously, spiritually, something is happening to where we're responding to our own inner guidance more and more. And man, if we could just put more attention on that at an early, early age where kids can get not even get started, because this is a systemic thing. I mean, my hat's off to Skyway House and people that they actually have their boots on the ground. I mean, I did it for a year, and be honest with you, I was so happy to get out of that realm. It was tough.
It's a lot of pain, huh?
Oh my gosh! I couldn't leave it at work. You know, it attached to me, and it takes a special kind of people to do this every single day and deal with it on a daily basis.
Does anybody else want to comment on why the U.S. has a legal and illegal drug problem much more than our population? Chris?
Well, big pharma. There's so much profit. If you follow the money on anything, you'll find oftentimes what the roots are of things. And so they're always trying to discover new sources of profit. So, you know, now they're looking at the orphan diseases that weren't profitable before.
What's an orphan disease?
They're the diseases that are, you know, that only a few thousand people get every year, the rare diseases. But they can make a lot of money because people are desperate. And then also with, you know, cancer and other diseases. I mean, they have drugs now that they're marketing, putting huge marketing behind that extend your life by maybe 2 months at the most. I mean, it's not ethical. And so, you know, it's not just the whole realm of narcotics and, you know, and all of that, sleep and anti-anxiety and psych meds that are being used. Like, they're generalizing the use of a lot of psych meds for things that they weren't intended for originally, you know, using them off-label for other things. So they, you know, however they can get more money, milk these things for more money, that's what they do. And they have pharmaceutical reps that come around and, you know, they bring you lunches, and there's some regulation on what they can't do now, but they still do a lot.
Oh, what bothers me the most is the drugs for kids, like for ADD and ADHD. Jennifer, do you want to say a word about that?
I somewhat disagree about that, because sometimes kids with ADHD actually do better. They have better self-esteem when they do take what is basically speed. But the problem is there's a lot of side effects with those medications. I don't think they're good for children's growth. I think that there's something better out there. And, you know, I really support parents who really work on it, you know, and diet and exercise and all the other things. Because a lot of kids now are called, they say they have ADHD and they're just normal kids. They just need large muscle movement. You know, they're active children.
They're boys.
They're probably healthy. They're boys. Yes.
Great. So if we were going to conclude, advice for someone who's listening who has an addict in the family, what would be your first suggestion for them? What should I do if I'm worried about a kid or a spouse or someone that I live with? Do you want to take that, Jennifer?
Well, we deal with families all day long, and I refer them to Al-Anon. This is a family disease, and you talk about this being a systemic issue, and it is. And it's systemic in our culture, but it's systemic within the family. And the family often needs treatment as much as the addict themselves. I think that Al-Anon is a great starting place for a family member. I think that treatment is always going to be something that I stand behind, as my own personal journey has proven that was successful. For me, the clients that we work with find great value in treatment.
Treatment meaning medical professionals or psych professionals?
Alcohol and drug counseling. So whether that's residential or outpatient services. And then, as I said, I will always refer someone to a 12-step program. But if I were speaking to a family member, oftentimes I'm going to ask that they take care of themselves so that they can then take care of the rest of the family. You know, oftentimes we're not going to be able to make a change in that addict's life. You know, you can't will them to make a change. But you can change your own reality, as Susan's talked about, and I think that that's a really powerful message.
So what if you have a child, like a teenager, who's an addict and doesn't want to do anything about it and is a binge drinker or whatever and refuses to change, and you live with them?
If there's a refusal to change, then again, Al-Anon, I mean, if you can't, you cannot change someone else. So as much as you want them to change, you can't. But you can cope with it yourself. And I think that Al-Anon is really key there. Or counseling, you know, individual counseling. I just think that taking care of yourself is where you need to be. And crafting your response to the situation is very important.
So crafting your response to a teen addict would be, what would that look like?
That's going to be different for every family. I don't, maybe somebody else wants to jump in. I mean, it depends on what the circumstances are. I would always suggest treatment. But if a teenager doesn't want to come into treatment, they're not going to. I mean, you can't drag them kicking and screaming. We've had an adolescent program for years, and it's very difficult for them at that age to recognize that a change is necessary and that they're going to voluntarily do that.
So. Especially in a town like Chico, where beer parties are the norm, and it's like cool to get drunk. Somehow it was your freshman year in college, rite of passage, you should get drunk a lot. I don't really understand that.
I don't know. I think that adolescents are bulletproof. They don't see that the risky behavior that they have can be self-sabotaging, and I don't think they understand the risks.
There's a book, I think Daniel Goldman wrote it, on the adolescent brain, and I think it would be useful for parents and adults to read about their own brain and why they make the choices that they do, or the poor choices, even, because it's part of a developmental. They say the brain doesn't stop growing until
25.
In your 20s. And so I think if kids can understand that, you're arming them, and parents too.
Right. He said the adolescent brain seeks adventure and risk and peer bonding, and so it's part of the evolutionary process.
Yeah, but if they have this knowledge, then they can help them understand themselves.
Right. Thank you so much. And if people want to listen again, it'll be on the KZFR archives. So thank you, panel. Really appreciate it. Stay tuned for peanut butter and jelly time.